Welcome to The More Perfect Union, a podcast about the joy we get from American politics, or as we like to call it, real debate without the hate. Hi, I'm Kevin Kelton. I'll be your moderate Democrat from California.
I'm Cliff Dunn. I'm your Republican from Virginia.
I'm Greg Matuszak, that liberal Democrat you ordered from Cincinnati, Ohio.
Hi there, I'm DJ McGuire, your conservative Democrat from Suffolk, Virginia.
And A More Perfect Union can be found on iTunes, iHeartRadio, and at our website, moreperfectunionpodcast.com. So, gentlemen, we've had a very interesting week this week, with some cabinet appointments already coming in, or at least, if not cabinet appointments, high-level White House appointments. Jeff Sessions at Attorney General, Michael Flynn at National Security Advisor, and what was the third one, CIA Director? Who was that again?
Congressman Pompeo, if memory serves.
Yeah. What do you guys think? Are these good choices? Obviously, they're controversial.
You know, last week we had this whole feeling like the picture of the dog with the room on fire saying, you know, it's fine. We're going to be okay. Everything is fine. And that is not the case for Democrats, for liberals, for everybody. Jeff Sessions, as Attorney General, this is a man who was turned down for judge. And when I say racist, I mean racist statements that he's made in the past. And they're not borderline. I mean, they're racist. And now he's going to be Attorney General? Someone, please, in a friendly way, disagree with me or talk me down from this ledge.
I'm not sure whether we should necessarily beat up Mr. Sessions for things he said 30 or 40 years ago, when the things he said 30 or 40 days ago still give us plenty of ammunition to blow this guy the hell out of Washington, D.C. Let us not forget, just 6 weeks ago, he could not properly answer what is and what isn't sexual assault. So for women across the country, including those who have talked endlessly about whether or not rape culture exists, and I'll be honest, I've been a skeptic about this for a good long while, with Attorney General Designate Sessions, I give up. Yeah, rape culture definitely exists when somebody who can't acknowledge what sexual assault is going to be the chief law enforcement official in the country.
Okay, I'm going to play devil's advocate, and I know I'm going to really upset a lot of our left of center listeners with this, because anything that I say that, you know, doesn't lambast President-elect Trump, I get told that I'm a sellout. But, you know, I have no fondness for what Jeff Sessions said about the Trump Access Hollywood tape and all of the follow-up stuff about sexual harassment, sexual assault. But you know what? He was supporting his candidate, and I'm not sure whether he believes what he said. I'm not sure we should hold him accountable for stuff that was said on the campaign trail, much as I disagree with it, by the way. I am, however, upset about Jeff Sessions being the Attorney General because of his very, very conservative religious political views. I think he is going to turn back the clock on social justice in this country 50 to 60 years. He will not defend the Civil Rights Act when it's brought up in cases. He will not defend a woman's right to choose. He will not defend any type of civil rights cases. And what he will do is actively adjudicate things that are friendly to the religious right. So that, to me, is the issue with Jeff Sessions, not what he said about Donald Trump's Access Hollywood tape.
You know, I'd like to jump in there and point out something, because this is actually a good segue into a thought I've been having all week, and that is, you're having a lot of these shots lobbed at Trump and the people he's picking, but how many of these shots would be getting lobbed at any Republican or almost any Republican? I mean, though he's ineligible, Arnold Schwarzenegger might not be making some of these sorts of appointments, but, you know, the talk about, quote-unquote, turning back the clock on women's rights, that's something that would be coming at any Republican president.
True,
Trump,
true, but Sessions is on the far, far extreme side of the religious right argument.
I would say that any pro-life attorney general is going to have some of these things, some of these charges, these things thrown at them. It's part of the political give and take. And in some case, if it were just that, then I would say, yeah, that's probably not necessarily fair. The fact that he felt he needed to pretzelize himself for support of a candidate, the fact that advancing Donald Trump was more important than clearly defining sexual assault, that's not an excuse. That's a further exacerbation of the problem. And in fact, it goes to one of the things that I think is actually happening, and that essentially the Trump stain is now polluting the entire Republican Party. You have Jeff Sessions saying what he is saying, supposedly in the heat of a campaign. You have Rince Priebus now saying that all of Islam is problematic, or that parts of it are problematic, because he's Trump's chief of staff now after he defended Steve Bannon of Breitbart fame. I mean, the simple fact of the matter is you have people who are now saying, okay, Trump is our guy, and in the process they are badly soiling themselves. Jeff Sessions did it 6 months ago. Rince Priebus did it 12 hours ago.
I believe it's
this is now spreading to the entire party. Yes, if Jeff Sessions were just pro-life, then I would say, okay, some of this is over the top and it's an overreaction. But Jeff Sessions has brought this upon himself with some of the things that he said during the campaign.
No, he's an awful man. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying he's no worse than Giuliani. He's no worse than Rince Priebus. And he's no worse than Kellyanne Conway. They all defended him. And so what are you going to do? Deny the man the staff that he wants? He won. I hate it. If I could turn back the clock, I would. But he won. He's going to be president. And he gets to hire who he wants.
Yeah, but have you actually read some of the things that he did say? Let's not bring up the stuff he said 30 years ago. But some of that stuff from 30 years ago, not only did he say the NAACP and the ACLU was un-American and communist.
But Greg, if the Senate does not confirm Sessions, we get Attorney General Ted Cruz, or we get Attorney General Rudy Giuliani. To me, there's no good coming out of this. Personally, I think Democrats have to pick our fights, because we're going to have big fights coming with the Supreme Court appointment.
Ted Cruz is not my favorite person, but I'm worried that this is going to happen in the next, let's say, 3 months, 4 months, 2 months, 2 weeks. An innocent African-American teenager is going to be killed by a police officer. It's going to happen soon.
I agree.
And the local authorities are not going to do anything. The state authorities are not going to do anything. And everyone's going to say, oh, gosh, that was a shame. And it is then up to our federal authorities to say, wait, we need to step in and protect someone's civil rights. And when you have an attorney general who says, oh, I don't know, sounds like he had it coming.
This is interesting, because this is the first time I think where the two Democrats are really at odds here. You guys can just sit back and watch. So to get back to Greg's point, I share your disillusionment with the state of the world as it really is these days.
Oh, no, it's utter fear.
Utter fear.
Okay, go on.
But I agree with you that lives are going to be lost. And you're right. The Justice Department is not going to lift a finger. We live in a different world now. And I hate to cast aspersions, and I'm going to get a lot of angry letters over this. But you know what? The black community that did not turn out in North Carolina, that did not turn out in Michigan, that did not turn out in Florida, they have no one to blame but themselves. What were they thinking?
Okay. Flag on the play. Because, among other things, we now know that more people voted in the 2016 election than voted in any presidential election in history, including 2008. If you look at USElectionAtlas.org, which is Dave Leap's site, you find that the number of folks who voted in 2016 is now over 132 million. I think it's approaching 133 million. More than voted in 2012, more than voted in 2008. Exit polls show that African Americans were about 12% of the total vote, just slightly down from the 13% they were in 2012. And given that more voters actually voted in 2016, it is quite possible that about the same number of African Americans actually voted. So I'm not necessarily ready. I'm not going to throw the African-American community under the bus on this one.
Well,
the simple fact of the matter is, if you look at the places where Trump won that may have been even a small surprise or a large surprise, there were five states: Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Florida. Four of them had Republican Senate incumbents running. All four won. All four got higher shares of the vote than Donald Trump did, and three of them actually got more actual voters in terms of numbers than Donald Trump did. Toomey was a little less in Pennsylvania. This was a standard issue Republican victory. that Trump disguised because he was on top of the ticket. This is about regular Republican voters and center-right voters who, for whatever reason, simply could not do what I did and pull the lever for Hillary Clinton. They stayed Republican and voted for Trump. A number of them voted for Gary Johnson. It would be enough to flip some of those states if we can get them on our side now. But the simple fact of the matter is this was a center-right electorate outside of California where a Republican wasn't running for Senate. That depressed Republican turnout. But this was a center-right electorate that showed up and voted. And they voted for what they hope is a center-right president. They're not going to get it. And I think that's our avenue for building inroads in 2020.
It wasn't just the center-right. I would say it was many Reagan Democrats who we all saw them. Reagan Democrats from Michigan and Wisconsin, who were the working class, who all voted en masse for Reagan, but then were Democrats true and true, then went to the right for Trump. And that's pretty standard. And that's where we saw didn't trust the Clintons and whatnot. I mean, I don't think it was a center right as much as the center left.
If that is true, Greg.
Greg.
Now I'm getting the two of you confused.
Democrats look alike. Go ahead.
I know, we all do now.
I hear that all the time.
If that was true, why did Ron Johnson get more votes than Donald Trump in Wisconsin? Why did Richard Burr get more votes than Donald Trump in North Carolina? This election wasn't personal. That's what I'm trying to get. This was a party election. This was a Republican victory. And when Donald Trump doesn't act like a typical Republican, when he goes off on his nonsense, that's where we can peel off voters from the Trump coalition. If we lose sight of that, if we veer leftward, Donald Trump will beat us again.
Okay, I just want to jump in one thing about the numbers of this election, and then I want to move on to another topic. DJ, you're right. There were more voters this time than there were in 2008. But considering population growth, it should have been 136 to 140 million. People didn't show up. Every election that we have, the number of voters generally goes up significantly from the 4 years before. This time, it's parallel to what we had in 2012. It should have gone up another 3 million votes. Trump also had a very interesting meeting today with a gentleman who's not being considered for any cabinet or high-level White House positions, Ari Emanuel, who is one of the main agents at the William Morris / Endeavor Agency in Hollywood, California. Guys, do you have any idea what this means when Donald Trump decides during his transition to take a meeting with a big-time, big-deal Hollywood agent?
He's planning a reality show?
No.
He wants tickets to Hamilton?
He wants something about Hamilton. This guy used to represent Donald Trump. This guy is the model for the Jeremy Piven character on Entourage. He is one of the toughest, one of the nastiest, and one of the most power-hungry men in Hollywood. And I can say that because I have no career left for him to ruin. He is the classic guy who can end a career with one or two phone calls. And I'm telling you, my theory is Donald Trump got a little pissed off that he was getting lambasted by a lot of people in Hollywood. And then specifically, he saw Alec Baldwin come back on Saturday Night Live to lampoon him. Then he heard what happened when Mike Pence went to see Hamilton. And he called in Ari to say, Ari, there's a lot of money to be made in the next 4 to 8 years. There's a lot of things that are going to go down with mergers that may or may not happen that I would like your input on, so, you know, you can tell me what you think should happen. Hint, hint, wink, wink, you'll have inside information. But we have to do something about all of this disloyalty coming from the left in Hollywood. And you know what? I think Ari Emanuel would happily call Bob Greenblatt at NBC and say, if Alec Baldwin is still doing Donald Trump impressions on Saturday Night Live come January, it's going to be very difficult for us to help you cast your pilots this spring.
You know, I don't think Alec Baldwin fears anyone at this point. I mean,
well, he may not, I'm telling you that this could happen, and everyone who doesn't think this could happen has not spent time in Hollywood.
I'm not saying this because I'm trying to get a career in Hollywood started, Mr. Emanuel, call me, please.
Greg, you got a face for radio.
DJ, what do you think?
I do.
I'm sorry. As soon as you mentioned Ari Emanuel, I realized you'd go off on your conspiracy tangent and I'd have the time to switch from Fireball to Kahlua and milk.
Pour me one, please.
Look, to be honest, there is a bit of schadenfreude in me that would love to actually see this pan out and to watch Hollywood essentially knuckle under to Donald Trump and have us all be reminded that, yes, not only is Hollywood a business, but Hollywood really is the last of the Sicilian mob. But I will acknowledge Hollywood is not my thing. I do not have the experience there. But let's actually think about what happens if let's say Donald Trump does get Hollywood to knuckle under. Then what you would probably see, frankly, is you would see the best 4 years for Bollywood in its entire history. Cinema and art is more international now than it has ever been. There are other places for people to go. There are places that would gladly welcome them in and get the stamp of Donald Trump hates us. Can you think of a better seal of approval?
Bollywood? Are you serious?
Yeah, Bollywood is huge now. It really is.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
I know. We are all getting off your lawn right now.
No, I'm staying on his lawn and I'm telling him, don't be so narrow-minded, jingoistic, and provincial, Kevin. You need to live in the post-American 21st century. We are a bigger world now, or a smaller world, however the hell you want to define it. But the simple fact of the matter is we are more international, we are more globalized. And yes, if you have a situation where word gets out that Donald Trump has essentially gotten Hollywood to knuckle under and you can't put out any decent anti-Trump art, then the rest of the world is going to gladly pick up the slack. And if Joss Whedon basically says, you know what, I'm going to Bollywood, folks, I'll see you, he can probably take half the acting crew with him. And if Ari Emanuel thinks he can probably pull this off and says, how I would not be surprised at all if that leads a bunch of actors to say, you know what, the hell with it, we'll start our own representation group, or we'll just challenge them. I mean, if memory serves, DreamWorks got started because a bunch of executives got pissed off within one of the big companies and put up the middle finger and said, we'll do it on our own.
Yeah, well,
I find no reason to believe that couldn't happen now.
I'm going to agree with DJ here as well that I get a feeling that given Hollywood politics being what it generally is, I suspect if Ari Emanuel turned around and tried to put some stick about in Hollywood, the response would be that the SAG would basically turn around and blacklist Ari Emanuel and say, fine, then none of us are going to work with you.
You guys have no idea how Hollywood works. You guys have no idea how Hollywood works.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with Kevin on that. All I know is the boycott Hamilton thing. That's not happening, no matter how much the conservatives. If any conservative is listening right now and is like, well, I'm just not going to use these tickets right now, please, please call me because I'm on like a 5-year waiting list. Of course, that's also a payment plan for me to pay.
That will be the most profitable boycott in the history of the world.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Those $1,400 seat tickets will go down to $1,200.
Yeah.
And I am so amused that Trump actually tweeted out that Hamilton was overrated. He is living in such a fantasy world. This guy's mind. I would love to spend 5 minutes inside this guy's head.
And see, Kevin, that's going to be the problem if he tries to pull this game with Ari Emanuel or anyone else, because they will all know, they will all recognize, okay, this guy is just as stupid about what's best for the Hollywood business as he is stupid about what's best for the rest of the business community. He doesn't get us. He doesn't understand us. Yes, he may try to muscle this, that, or the other. And when he does, we should all criticize him for it, no doubt. But I don't think this is necessarily something he's going to succeed. For crying out loud, Mike Pence's response to Hamilton was to nudge his kids and point at the stage and say, this is what freedom looks like. So how exactly is Trump going to do this when his own vice president is essentially undermining him?
Okay,
look,
let's talk in 3 years.
I'm not saying don't be afraid. I'm not saying don't be vigilant. What I am saying is don't be so pessimistic as to assume everything Trump does he will succeed at. He won't. He's going to fail, and he's going to fail spectacularly on certain things. I think that's one of them.
All right. Well, I agree with you that he's going to fail. I just don't know whether that's one of them.
So all right, my Trump rash is really getting quite large. So let's talk. Every time I talk about Trump too long, I get a rash. So let's talk about something else that will probably give me hives. Let's talk about the DNC chair.
Yeah.
Oh, crap.
Yeah, now let's move to another election for the DNC chair. Keith Ellison versus Howard Dean, and I think there's also one other person running to take over the chairmanship of the DNC.
Who would want that job?
It seems like a lot of good people are backing Representative Keith Ellison, including Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, Charles Schumer. However, my concern, much as I have no opinion on Keith Ellison, I know who he is. He seems like a very capable congressman. I think we've already seen in the last couple of years that this is not a job for someone who already has a full-time job, that of being a U.S. congressman. And the idea that you could be the DNC chair and be an active congressman gives me great concern, which is what Howard Dean says when he advocates his own candidacy.
I tend to agree with the concern. I mean, they both seem to come from the same general wing of the party, so I don't think it's a matter of policy difference. I think it really is a matter of, can Keith Ellison do this while he's, you know, also dealing with legislative fights and so forth on the Hill, or do you really need somebody who can put their full back into it? And frankly, I tend to agree with Howard Dean on this one. It's McAuliffe didn't have another job when he was chair. Dean didn't when he was chair. Wasserman Schultz was special.
Donna Brazile started out with a different job, but that soon ended.
Yeah. I tend to like the general principle of the people in the top tier of party positions should probably not also be elected officials, because inevitably something ends up looking squirrely.
I agree.
Right. Are they responsible to their constituents, or are they responsible to the party first? You never know. And you have to be loyal. You can't serve two masters. But the one thing that's been bothering me about this is that Bernie Sanders is endorsing Ellison and not Dean, because Bernie Sanders stole his whole shtick from Dean. I mean, Dean is the original crazy guy from the Northeast who comes out and just screams and gets people, the guy who takes just a little bit from everybody and gets people just crazy. That's Dean.
The Democratic Party has won exactly three federal elections in the 21st century, and Howard Dean was DNC chair for two of them. That should not be ignored. An Ellison election would help, you know, probably check some identity boxes. Having a Muslim party chair could be useful in many ways. But beyond that, the question of who is the National Committee chairman is not necessarily, it is just not something that is particularly relevant to the average voter. I think it's much more interesting, the contest between now Tim Ryan of Ohio and Nancy Pelosi for House Minority Leader, because that's someone who will speak for the party in Congress, who will essentially be one of the lead loyal opposition spokespeople, who will have microphones in their face all the time as they address this issue, that issue, this policy, the other policy. I think that's really the much more important contest here, because frankly, National Committee Chairman is all about party nuts and bolts. It's about party organization. You don't get to speak a lot on policy matters. I think the Pelosi-Ryan race is really much more important for the future of the Democratic Party. And I say this as someone who's admired Pelosi. I admire her tough stance against the Chinese Communist Party. And I think Tim Ryan, frankly, is not getting in on economic issues. But this is the chance for us, still getting used to that, to really have the debate about where the party should go in the future. And I think that's a much more important debate to be had, and a much more important race, than who is or who isn't the DNC chairman.
Yeah, I agree. And I do like Nancy Pelosi, especially when she was the House Speaker. But it's time for her to step aside and let some young blood step in. If we've learned nothing else from this election, we've learned that Democrats have to find new voices, new ideas, and a new direction. And we cannot find that with Nancy Pelosi leading the House Minority Caucus.
Yeah, if I was in y'all's shoes, my biggest worry would be that the House leadership elections happen and the exact same three people are leading the House Caucus as led it, you know, into this election. And that sends all sorts of the wrong messages. Now,
I agree, Cliff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And the best thing about Tim Ryan, though, he's from Ohio. So I mean, really, if that's not an endorsement in itself,
well, that's,
Ohio.
That's something for Greg to be thankful for, which leads us to our final topic for tonight. It is our pre-Thanksgiving episode. And I thought, actually, Emily, who couldn't be with us tonight, she suggested that maybe we speak about what we're thankful for and maybe what we're looking forward to on our Thanksgiving tables to this week. So, Greg, I'll start with you. Tell us a little bit about what you're thankful for and what kind of a Thanksgiving you'll be spending.
Well, I'm thankful, of course, for my friends. All of them are here, obviously, because I have none others and I never get to see them. I'm kidding. I'm thankful for all my friends. I'm thankful for my family. I'm thankful for my children who are wonderful and who enrich my life. But on the big picture of things, you know, I'm thankful that we live in a really great country, that we can talk about these things and not be put in prison yet for these things. No Jeff Sessions. And as far as what I'm looking forward to, we always go down to my in-laws. And my wife makes a butter rose. She makes a rose out of butter, which for some reason impresses me. And she's like, oh, this is just something I do. And she whittles a rose out of butter. And I am fascinated by that. And once again, just one of her many talents.
Cliff?
Well, you know, I'm thankful for all of my friends. My parents have passed away some years ago. As did my grandparents, but I'm thankful for the friends that I've had around me in the years since, y'all included. And I apologize to our listeners as I attempt to give you all diabetes. But no, I've been very fortunate in those who have been around me ever since then. And so for Thanksgiving, I'm going to a friend of mine's family's house, and Dad makes the greatest stuffing. He makes his oysters in. And then last year they experimented with, and it worked. They have an iced tea sangria that somehow works brilliantly that I'm looking forward to with Thanksgiving dinner.
You know, I have always wanted to taste oyster stuffing. I've heard about it all my life, and I've never had a chance
Me
to
too.
Eat it.
Me too. That sounds delicious. I may do that this year.
DJ?
It's great.
Well, first and foremost, I am thankful for my beautiful wife, who has watch me go through what can only be described as a midlife political crisis as I have traversed from conservative Republican to very conservative Democrat and all the things in between on my way there. And Frank, you know, I'm thankful for all of you and for all the friends I have, but I also want to give a shout out to our listeners who have made us so big, far bigger than any of us deserve, especially me. The notion that the four or the five or the six of us warbling about the events of the day can bring so much joy and so much happiness to so many people, it just really humbles me. For this Thanksgiving, I will actually be – we'll probably be driving for most of it because we've got a convention. I'll also be seeing my younger adopted son for the first time in a couple of years. He comes back up from Texas. So I'm thankful that I'll be able to spend some time with him and his brothers again.
That's great. That's great. And
what about you, Kevin?
I'm thankful for the 22nd Amendment. Which means
wait.
That
you're telling me you didn't want the president? Oh, the current president to run for a third term?
I knew that somebody would say that. I'm forward looking at this point. Okay. I know that at worst, all we can have is 8 years of Trump and then 8 years of Ivanka Trump, and then that'll be it. I am obviously grateful for you guys. I'm grateful for my kids, Max and Marnie, who support me even though they will never listen to this show. I am grateful for our audience because, as DJ mentioned, it has grown leaps and bounds, and we really are honored that people actually care about what we think. And I'm looking forward to 2017. I refuse to look at it negatively. So I'm going to tell you what's going on. And as we're recording this right now, my daughter has walked into the room to show me that one of our toilets has overflown. So that's what I'm thankful for, that I've got a plunger someplace in the house. And with that, I won't even go into what we're going to be serving for Thanksgiving. I'm going to say thank you to our listeners. Please like us on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast and share your link with your Facebook friends on your newsfeed so they can find us too. And if you enjoy political debates and would like to be a part of ours, join us on Facebook in our political discussion group, Open Fire. We're all there, and we'd love to see you too. Until next week, everybody, have a fantastic Thanksgiving, and we'll see you soon.
Happy Thanksgiving. Good night. You can say that again, Kevin.